We're going to start our afternoon session here. We're going to start out today talk about EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. We have Dr. Mary Lee from the Florida Cancer Specialist, Spring Hill, Florida. Dr. Natasha Lael from the Princess Margaret Cancer Center in Toronto, Canada. And Dr. Jonathan Goldman from the UCLA Health in Santa Monica, California. So here are the speakers that we have coming in here this weekend. And we have like a little thing we like to do every now and then just to get them, just to kind of keep people awake here. It's called our Good Questions video. Here's another one.
Great question.
That's a great question.
That's a really important question.
It's a good question.
That's an excellent question.
Yeah, that's a great question.
I think it's a good question.
Good question.
A lot of good questions.
That is a great question.
Excellent question. I think this is particularly a good question to ask.
So I think there were at least 9 really good questions.
Neil, that's a great question.
This is a very important question.
I think that's an excellent question.
I think that's a great question.
I don't know why we do these things, but yeah. All right, well, we're going to start out talking about the management of non-metastatic EGFR tumors with activating mutations. Dr. Lael is going to talk about, and then we'll talk about new developments and also management of exon 20. Along the way, we'll see if Mary has a few cases and questions she'd like to bring up. But let's begin with a little bit of data here, Natasha. If you could kind of review some of the more recent important developments.
Sure, and thank you so much. I'm really honored to be here today and to enjoy this wonderful weather, which has not yet made it to Canada. So what's been so great over the last 20 years of treating lung cancer is now for our patients with EGFR mutated lung cancer, we have targeted therapy from stage 1 to stage 4, whether it's adjuvant osimertinib in our patients from 1B to 3A resected disease, consolidation osimertinib for those patients that get chemoradiation, a number of first-line options, and I'll review the data for these, and you're familiar with these, and now improvements on chemotherapy after TKI failure. So you know these data well, and from my perspective, it's very clear that adjuvant osimertinib for 3 years, we don't know the ideal duration yet, but for 3 years for now, in patients with 3 centimeters or greater of EGFR mutant lung cancer resected, adjuvant TKI is really the standard. I think the challenge has been making sure that the surgeons refer patients with these smaller tumors because I think they're used to stage 2 and stage 3. So really important to get out there and hammer that message home. Great disease-free survival, to everyone's surprise, great overall survival even past the 3 years when the osimertinib stops, and just as in advanced disease, that promise of great intracranial control. Now, does everybody need chemotherapy? And I will say in this trial, everyone was to have chemotherapy by guidelines. So if you had 1B disease resected, no, you didn't get adjuvant chemotherapy. If you had stage 2 and stage 3, most people did. And in particular, I'll draw your attention, this is from the appendix, but if you had stage 2 and stage 3 resected disease and you got both chemotherapy and osimertinib, you had the best long-term outcome. So if you have stage 2 or stage 3 resected disease, we would normally give adjuvant chemotherapy, so I talk about it with all my patients. Make sure, though, to never miss the osimertinib. Now, can we use ctDNA and novel technology to figure out who needs and who doesn't and who needs more? And I think the answer is sadly not yet. We know that if you never have ctDNA present or detected, you do much better on adjuvant targeted therapy than if you're on the placebo arm and have ctDNA detected. But what's interesting is, you know, maybe as many as a third of patients perhaps don't need anything after surgery, but who are these people really? And some of our patients, despite adjuvant TKI, perhaps need something more. Some of these people do have ctDNA detected. It is a prognostic feature, but today we don't know what to do. So in Canada, if we don't know what to do with a result, we don't order the test. So that's my little Canadian take home for all of you. We saw these great data at ASCO this past year and saw a wonderful publication in the New England Journal. For all of our patients with EGFR mutant lung cancer with unresectable stage 3 disease, chemoradiation followed by observation has really not been a great standard of care. We know that durvalumab doesn't improve outcomes and is potentially dangerous when patients need to start osimertinib later. So it's been great to see in the LAURA study, after chemoradiation for unresectable disease, patients were randomized 2-1 to standard dose osimertinib, but with no end in sight. So it wasn't just 2 years or 3 years, it was until disease progression. Patients did amazingly well in terms of progression-free survival. Survival data, I think we'll see later. I think this will look better over time, and already a signal that we protect in brain, which of course you knew was going to happen. What's my big take home for doing this? Beware of the pulmonary toxicity, an increase in radiation pneumonitis of about 10% compared to placebo, and interstitial lung disease. So just be very, very mindful of radiation field, patient's symptoms, and just be very mindful of managing your patient's toxicity. So what about in the first line setting? You know, it was so great when we had drugs like osimertinib that could replace gefitinib and erlotinib and erfatinib, improving both progression-free and overall survival. But sadly, all great stories come to an end, and so the real question is, how do we move beyond? And there have been two great intensified approaches, FLAURA2, where we add standard chemotherapy, pemetrexed and carboplatin, and then you continue with maintenance. Great progression-free survival data, as you see here. Also long-term, great overall survival data. Just remember, you know, the curves don't cross until about 15 months, so there are some people that we can potentially harm with this approach, so you need to pick wisely and discuss with your patients. But long-term, clear benefit at 2 and 3 years. Same response rate, it's really the duration of response or being able to prolong that great story. Interestingly, even though the intracranial response is not higher when you add chemotherapy to osimertinib, gosh, this looks like a great waterfall plot, right? This is Niagara Falls, Canadian side, my friends, with all of these complete responses compared to osimertinib alone, which is already a great drug in brain. And so, you know, why? We don't really understand. Clearly, the blood-brain barrier is not as impermeable as we thought, but definitely an important step forward if your patient has brain metastasis. More toxicity, but known toxicity. One visit every 3 weeks. More discontinuation, especially, I think, the maintenance pemetrexed, which is something that we've seen in the chemo IO data as well. What else? A chemo-free approach with MARIPOSA, amivantamab and lazertinib compared to osimertinib. And then just because lazertinib is a third-gen TKI, just like osimertinib, really, from Korea, that was also part of the trial, just to look at the contribution of components. Better progression-free survival with the combination and the OC and lazertinib curves, very similar here. Again, similar response rate, but much bigger, greater duration of response. And again, you know, these curves are very close together, a little cross just before 12 months, but then long-term, the combination is better at 2 and 3 years. And we've also just heard through a news release that now this difference is statistically significant, and we look forward to seeing it at an upcoming conference. Now, what about in brain? Amivantamab is a big molecule. Lazertinib, of course, gets into the brain just like osimertinib. But interestingly, you know, after about 2 years, it does seem to outperform a single agent TKI in terms of PFS and duration of response intracranially. Rash, infusion reactions, these are things that we see very commonly with amivantamab, more burden of treatment. You have to come weekly for the first 4 weeks and then every 2 weeks. But what was interesting in this trial that we didn't see in any of the other amivantamab and lazertinib trials, the Chrysalis series, was a much higher rate of venous thrombotic events, almost all in the first 4 months. And based on that, when you start your patients on this combination, the recommendation is that you give them prophylactic doses of anticoagulation for the first 4 months. As I said, you know, we've heard now top-line results, better survival, about a year in terms of median improvement or more than a year, so it'll be really great to see these data. You know, this concept that intensifying at the beginning helps long-term rather than sequence, I think, is something that's always been a challenge for us in lung cancer. So who needs intensified therapy? High-risk patients and patients who want people with brain metastasis, clearly, liver metastases, co-alterations. We'll hear a bit about that in the cases. You know, if you have plasma ctDNA at baseline, you do have a slightly worse prognosis. And even if you clear it over time, probably combinations are better. L858R, patients with L858R mutant lung cancer also seem to do better with combinations than single agent OC. But it is a real trade-off. You know, we can improve outcomes, but there's still that incredible attraction of monotherapy. People go back to work, they travel, they're hospital-free, and the toxicity profiles are much better. So a challenge to discuss this, a challenge for patients to process, but I really, this is something that I discuss with my patients in some detail so they can make the best choice for them. So how do we do better? Subcutaneous amivantamab has been incredibly promising. We're waiting for the final marketing approval. Non-inferior compared to intravenous, perhaps better in terms of PFS and OS, but time will tell, but a clear winner in terms of convenience and fewer side effects, in particular, fewer infusion-related reactions. Half an hour to give as opposed to many hours. This is great stuff. In terms of rates of venous thromboembolic events, lower whether patients were anticoagulated or whether they refused to have prophylaxis. So definitely a step forward compared to IV amivantamab, and I think we're just looking forward to being able to access this. So, you know, one of the questions I often get is, well, that's third line. So PALOMA-3 was after osimertinib and platinum-based chemotherapy. What about first line? Does this apply to MARIPOSA? And certainly, I think in terms of the data that we have, very high response rates first line, 79%, very similar to what we saw in the IV MARIPOSA. Again, very nice improvement in the risk of infusion-related reactions and thrombotic events and similar PK. So I think the answer is yes, we can substitute this across the board. What else are we learning about prophylaxis? So giving minocin or doxycycline for the first 12 weeks prophylactically, chlorhexidine soaks for your fingernails, as well as topical agents, and using dexamethasone, 8 milligrams twice a day, 2 days before and the day before, markedly drives down the rate of IRRs. Now, what about on progression? And I think Dr. Goldman is going to talk about some of these exciting new data, but, you know, local therapy wherever we can and keep going, and a new standard for systemic progression, amivantamab and platinum, and I think in all of our patients, really important to characterize molecular resistance with tissue or with plasma. Sorry, here we go. So many different types of resistance, so many emerging approaches, so confusing in the clinic, what's available, what's not available, what's evidence-based, what's not. I really work hard to get my patients on trials wherever they are, doubling down on EGFR, 797S, MET amplification, very, very promising, or other emerging resistance mechanisms. And Dr. Goldman's going to talk a bit about some of these great new drugs. We're going to hear about patritumab deruxtecan at ASCO and how it improves progression-free survival and is perhaps a new standard. And also chemotherapy plus VEGF and PD-1 inhibitors like ivonescimab. We've already seen some early data. So how does resistance change? Well, it does change a little bit. You probably do see less transformation when you start with chemo and OC, and you do definitely see less MET amplification, EGFR resistance mechanisms, and perhaps even a little less transformation when you start with amivantamab and lazertinib. So I think we have to be thoughtful now about how our frontline choice changes our second line. But I think definitely for patients that fail osimertinib, really must talk about this study, amivantamab plus chemotherapy. The original plan was amivantamab, lazertinib plus chemo, but again, for contribution of components, we looked at the three-drug regimen, very clear improvement in progression-free and intracranial progression-free survival. Again, how do these drugs get into the brain or how do they improve things? We really don't know. Also, much higher response rate, more toxicity, but manageable. So this is certainly a new standard. So much more to come. OC, amivantamab, chemotherapy, and then we'll hear about what's next. For patients on osimertinib and chemotherapy or amivantamab and lazertinib, it's a little more challenging. Chemotherapy for those who haven't had it before, novel agents and trials for those who have, but it's certainly a rapidly evolving field and much more complex. So make sure you test. Make sure that you can incorporate wherever you can the current standard for EGFR-targeted therapy. I think the intensified regimens are very exciting, and I think we have to talk about it with all of our patients. Second line after OC, amivantamab and chemo is our new standard, important to talk about with all of our patients, and much more to come. So with that, sorry to go over time. I want to thank you so much.
Great. So we have a bunch of questions we want to direct to you. And Mary, I want to start out in a second. If you have any questions or experiences in terms of EGFR mutant localized disease in the adjuvant or stage 3 setting. But Jonathan, one thing that Natasha kind of alluded to, I'm curious what you do in your practice in terms of the use of adjuvant osimertinib is, in what situations are you using chemotherapy in these patients? And also, who do you give osimertinib to? How low is your bar to offer osimertinib to?
So those are great questions.
All right.
The question of chemotherapy and osimertinib, I try to separate them as two separate questions. If they meet the criteria for chemotherapy, I remind patients, we have really high goals here. The difference between cancer recurrence and no is very significant for these patients. I do have to spend some time really highlighting that. Patients have become scared of chemotherapy, understandably, but I also remind them that platinum pemetrexed is a well-tolerated regimen. Osimertinib, many patients are very interested in it, not a hard sell, and if my line is following the trial, greater than 3 centimeters, I offer osimertinib. We just finished accrual on the ADORA 2 trial, which is 1 to 3 centimeter tumors, and that will be important. I think there, as opposed to other diseases, stage 1A lung cancer has a real risk of recurrence, which is problematic. And so I think there's a possibility that osimertinib will play a role, at least in the higher risk patients there.
So I'm curious too, Natasha, what your experience is with osimertinib in the adjuvant and metastatic setting in terms of common tolerability issues. And all this, also this issue of using it in, quote, lower risk patients, which, as Jonathan said, is really not necessarily that low, and whether you ever offer it to them. If, you know, somebody in your family had a 1.5 centimeter tumor, would you think about using osimertinib? And what are some of the tolerability issues you run into?
Thanks. So one of the challenges in Canada is we are really driven by the evidence and guidelines. And so we also participate in an ADORA 2. We tell patients we're waiting to hear. And we really do stick to that 3 centimeter or high-risk cutoff. So patients with smaller tumors that had, you know, adverse features also were part of the study. And so really only our patients with 3 centimeters or more can get it. Even if someone were a family member and they had it, you know, I would be eagerly awaiting the data, but I wouldn't give it today. Tolerability-wise, most of my patients have done very well. Most patients, you know, they're highly motivated, as Jonathan has said, but some of our patients, you know, they have had challenges, they have had severe rash, they have had paronychia, some patients have had some pulmonary issues, and so I have actually had a few young patients where we've decided to stop and surveil and watch closely. But I think what's important is, you know, they know the data, we tried, sometimes we try and dose reduce, but I would say 90% of my patients can get through.
So getting back to locally advanced disease, Jonathan, and actually even adjuvant, I'm curious whether you offer, or, you know, again, assuming you can access targeted therapy beyond EGFR, would you use adjuvant therapy for a patient with RET? Would you use post-chemoradiation targeted therapy? Again, RET, you know, BRAF, all the other mutations. Any thoughts about that?
So starting with the data side of it, we do know with ALK, based on the ALENA trial, that alectinib has a real and important role. That trial was alectinib versus chemotherapy. In practice, with a stage 2 or 3, I give both. I give chemo and follow that with alectinib, which isn't exactly what was on the trial, but I think makes sense. In the other tumors, I think where we have a really good drug and really good activity, especially CNS activity and good tolerability, and I put RET really high on that list, I certainly think about it. We are almost about to complete accrual, closing accrual for hopefully in the coming months on the Libretto 432 trial, which will put data behind that. I think it is important to run that trial in order to encourage testing for RET. Right now, a lot of people only do EGFR, so I hope that will help change that. I think that there are some tumors where I would not use an adjuvant TKI, KRAS being the first that comes to mind, partly because they really do generally do well with chemo and immunotherapy, and secondly, that the available drugs right now are, I don't think, good enough to really move the needle in the adjuvant setting. ROS1, I recently started a patient on a ROS1 inhibitor with a stage 3 disease, a lot of adverse features, young patient, and aggressive-minded, and think that's what I would do if I were in his shoes. But they are difficult, long discussions.
So, Mary, any experiences, cases, questions about localized treatment?
Localized disease, I have a case, a stage 3 patient, EGFR positive. We used osimertinib for 6 weeks pre-op, and it seems to have pretty good response.
You said pre-op. What about, so the patient went to surgery?
Yes.
Interesting. Natasha?
Neoadjuvant.
Excuse me?
Neoadjuvant.
Neoadjuvant. Interesting. Natasha, any thought? You know, there was a trial at one point looking at neoadjuvant and locally advanced. I thought it was a cool idea. Any thoughts?
So it is a great idea. I think the concern has been that for some reason, even though we see nice response rates, it's a question of cure, and are we getting complete pathologic response as we've seen with the pre-op chemo IO data? And I'm just not sure we've seen it. Great study, NeoAdora, hopefully will be presented this year to really test that hypothesis. But there's something about kinase inhibitors and mutated lung cancer. Sometimes it's really hard to cure with targeted therapy alone because of these drug persistent cells or drug tolerant cells. So that's been a challenge for me. I think if somebody, you know, can benefit from the downstaging, I think it's something that we definitely discuss at our tumor board. But if you can remove the tumor and then move on to adjuvant strategies, that's my recommendation.
Jonathan, any situations where you want to use neoadjuvant targeted therapy in general, EGFR, et cetera, to convert a patient to resectability?
So we do have several trials. We have the Nautica-1 trial. It does seem like, not surprisingly, not all TKIs, not all targets are the same. There may be real specific differences, for example, with ALK inhibitors compared to EGFR inhibitors. Colin Blakely and UCSF did a study of osimertinib and saw a very low path CR rate, I think it was zero, in the neoadjuvant setting. NeoAdora looked at chemotherapy also, and hopefully we'll see results coming soon. I think that it is unlikely in general that we can downstage a patient with a targeted therapy. Many times if you're going to need to do a pneumonectomy pre-therapy, often you're going to need to do a pneumonectomy post-therapy. But there are exceptions to that, often driven by the surgeon and the surgeon's take on things. I think if you have a patient that for example, has a delayed preoperative workup, due to cardiac disease, and you want to get started on systemic therapy, I think that's very appropriate. And sometimes you're happily surprised by a really nice response.
So, Mary, your patient got neoadjuvant surgery. Then did they get adjuvant therapy also?
Yes, I got adjuvant. The patient initially was, I was thinking it's not operable.
Huh.
And I spoke with the surgeon. We all did not think the patient was operable. Obviously, well, patient is already on treatment and went for a second opinion, and they repeated the scan. Then they ended up decided that yes, he probably could be operated. And actually, he went to MD Anderson for a second opinion after we already started him on treatment. And he was seen by Moffitt Cancer Center first, and the surgeon said he's not operable, and we would just go ahead and treat with TKI. So he actually right now doing pretty good.
Still on osimertinib?
Yes, still on treatment.
Interesting. So a question from the audience, Natasha. Any current role for the first generation and second generation TKIs, gefitinib, erlotinib, afatinib, dacomitinib?
Thanks. So in my daily practice, almost never. I think we're going to talk about a case, someone with a 797S alteration, and whether gefitinib, for example, might play a role there. Again, in my practice, my answer is no, but we'll hear other opinions. Erlotinib or erfatinib, if I've had difficulty with interstitial lung disease or pneumonitis with osimertinib or some of the cardiac effects, I, for the most part, you know, if you have a classic sensitizing mutation, I do recommend osimertinib. Certainly for the uncommon mutations, especially the exon 18, you know, G719X, those patients I will stream towards afatinib, although whenever possible, you know, if I can get them on a trial of osimertinib, for example, if they have L861Q or something like that, that's what I try and do.
All right, let's talk about maybe the most important decision we want to talk about in this session. Jonathan, first-line therapy of EGFR mutant disease. We thought it was easy. Right. Now it is not easy. You know, you hear talks like this great talk we just heard from Natasha, but then you're like, well, how do I think this through? How do I explain it to a patient? So can you give us a little more granularity about how you think it through, what a typical scenario is where you might use, you know, OC alone versus OC chemo versus AMI laser?
So you've got to assign a lot of time to those conversations. Many times, we'll be getting the EGFR result prior to the visit. If I already know the patient, I'll call them and say, we have this result, I'm going to prescribe osimertinib for you. And then when you come in, we'll talk more about other therapies that we could add to it. I appreciate that we've already got them on treatment. They appreciate it, often feel better within a few days. And then we consider whether adding chemotherapy is appropriate. In general, that's been my approach over an amivantamab combination, but I understand that there's appealing data on both sides. My feeling is that the chemotherapy every 3 weeks, very predictable toxicities of a few days of not feeling great, but usually at least a couple weeks of doing well, and the hazard ratio is very appealing there. The discussion of whether to do it or not, I find often patients have a strong opinion, and I do tell them I wouldn't give you any bad options. I think these are both reasonable options. A younger patient, someone with brain metastases, those are patients I often encourage to think about chemotherapy. The other risk factors like TP53, co-mutations, we know that it's a worse prognosis. We don't really have very great data suggesting that adding chemotherapy is particularly good for that group. But it's absolutely a reasonable consideration.
So, Mary, in a second, I'll ask you to pick one of your metastatic. They look pretty complicated. See, maybe you can kind of condense it down a little bit. But just getting back to this decision, Natasha, again, I'm kind of curious about how you think it through. And also, you know, what your experience is with amivantamab, lazertinib in terms of tolerability, how much you think that's going to be changed with sub-Q. Amy.
Thank you. So maybe I'll speak to the last part first. So amivantamab and lazertinib, it's been a wonderful combination. You know, we've seen people living longer and doing better. Is there a price? There is. This has increased treatment burden for patients. You come weekly for the first 4 weeks. After that, you come every 2 weeks. The third-gen TKI is very similar to what we see with osimertinib, but as a combination, more rash, paronychia, you're going to need to be best friends with your dermatology clinic. I refer all of my patients up front. We use the prophylaxis. We do whatever we can. The subcutaneous version has been great as a Canadian center. You know, we have no time, we have no room, we have no beds. You can get people in and out in 30 minutes. Reaction risk, almost zero. Not quite, but almost zero. So I think it will really help make this more tolerable. Also in the Paloma program, we are starting to look at less frequent dosing now so that we don't maybe have to do weekly for 4 weeks. So that'll be sort of hopefully the next wave of improvements for patients. So great outcomes, intense. When I talk to patients, I present it all. I really gravitate towards osimertinib as my preferred choice for patients with, you know, bilateral lung disease or pleural disease, people where the plasma test was negative, people maybe who have comorbidities or I think won't do well on chemo or amilaz. For my younger patients, I do talk up combinations more. What's interesting is when I recommend OC only, they go online and they go for combinations. When I recommend everything, most of them say, oh, you know what, I feel so well now on just the osimertinib alone, I'm just going to stick with this and I'll let you know. So in my perfect world, we will have a much better idea from these trials, you know, who is best served with amivantamab and lazertinib, who is best served by osimertinib and chemo, and can we have some adaptive approach, you know, osimertinib until your ctDNA turns positive, a great trial going on with the Dr. Helena Yu and team, and then what's the best intervention at that point? So that's my dream. Hopefully in a couple of years, we'll get there.
All right, Mary, you want to pick one of your cases?
Yes. Actually, one of my questions was in regard to who would best serve with chemo alone, who would be chemo with combination or TKI by itself. So you were talking about that would be our next step going to show. So this is a 68-year-old Asian male, never smoker, presented with a copious amount of foamy sputum, progressively getting worse with increased shortness of breath, and the oxygen saturation decreases a significant 25-pound weight loss. Patient had the symptom for 3 months, went to primary, got a CAT scan showing a lung mass with liver metastasis. So at the diagnosis, the patient already stage four. Biopsy report came back EGFR positive, and the positivity of the EGFR at the initial diagnosis was EGFR E746A750 deletion, EGFR exon 19, and the percentage of it at the time was 24.8%. At the same time, also showed P53 mutation at 38.5%. So then patient initially diagnosed with EGFR positive stage four, started on osimertinib, did very well. Within the first day after patient taking the medication, the sputum went away. The patient previously was described wearing a bottle with him everywhere he goes because he has so much fluid. He spit out 1 liter of sputum a day. Immediately after the first dose, the cough went away and breathing much better. Within 3 days, completely gone. Very drastic response. Within the first 6 months, did a very good, continue good response, and you're seeing tumor marker level coming down, patient symptom improve, and overall weight gain back to his normal. The response lasted for a little bit over a year. Then patient started to have symptom again, cough came back, and then a CT scan showing mild progression. So at that time, since that was in the early 2022, We talked about it in tumor board. We decided that we were going to go with chemo, Alimta with carbo. So patient received 6 cycles of treatment and followed by Alimta maintenance. And he did very well. Immediately after chemo treatment, within 2 rounds, he started to gain weight and his oxygen saturation improved, a similar situation. And then in March of 2023, by that time, the second time a patient had progression, actually, we did a repeat bronchoscopy. With the bronchoscopy was not yielding any positive or was insufficient. Then patient got COVID at the same time, then end up with 2 months of downtime. After that, patient the symptom get much worse, got significantly worse. Then we were able to do a repeat biopsy. The repeat biopsy EGFR mutation down to 13%, and there is a new EGFR mutation, C797S, so that is 8%. And then P53 is still at 20%. And low tumor mutation burden and PD-L1 expression is zero. So at that time, we decided, patient requested to get back on osimertinib. We know the response won't be very well, so we were talking about afatinib, and then patient finally got on afatinib, and not as drastic response, but response pretty good for the next 10 months, then progressed again. So in your opinion, of course, now we have a lot more options with a newer treatment. So in this case, with what we know now, what would we have done differently for this patient?
So Natasha, I'm curious about your thoughts about the case, particularly the extreme amount of sputum. She actually sent a picture of you know, like this liter of sputum. Have you seen that with EGFR mutant disease?
So not to that extent, or at least not anymore. You know, I think we still see it with our KRAS G12D mutant lung cancer patients and our HER2 insertion mutant lung cancer patients. Luckily, I guess for our EGFR patients, they respond so well, we don't get that story. So worried about this poor patient, so sick, poor prognosis, TP53 co-mutation. I would talk to this patient if they could tolerate something intensified, such as FLAURA2, even the Mariposa regimen. I would definitely try and push that if we could get away with it in terms of tolerability. Obviously, as an absolute minimum, the osimertinib.
You know, at that third line point, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, you know, when you switch to chemo, should we keep the osimertinib going? I don't know. There's a trial, right? The COMPEL trial. So interested to know how that reads out. Mm-hmm. And then if you didn't, what about rechallenge? So we actually have a study in Canada where we're looking at rechallenge. So not necessarily the afatinib, but the osimertinib. 797S makes us all very nervous. And I think Dr. Goldman's going to talk about some of these great new options maybe that work despite any alteration, you know, patritumab, deruxtecan, maybe some of these other ADCs. And then hopefully one day these 797S inhibitors will really come through.
So Jonathan, in a second I'll ask you to go through some of the data, but can you kind of give us a little bit of a glimpse of how you think through management of the patient who's been on, let's say, osimertinib alone, had a response and then progressed, and where do biomarkers fit in?
So, you know, ctDNA is appealing, a fast turnaround, and it's not perfect sensitivity, and depends on the type of progression, but can be as low as 50 to 60%. So tumor biopsy does still have a role. Most importantly, I think, to evaluate for transformation to small cell. Sometimes you can guess it based on just an incredible explosion of disease, unfortunately. But sometimes you can't guess it. Sometimes it doesn't look particularly bad and ends up being high-grade neuroendocrine on biopsy. In that case, we do want to use platinum etoposide and unfortunately know that we don't have great outcomes there, but would really look for a clinical trial for next treatment. We have a trial about to open, we hope, with tarlatamab in that situation, which would be exciting.
Yeah, bispecific, finally coming to a solid tumor oncology. Yeah. Any questions, Mary, that you want to hear them discuss?
In regard to circulating DNA testing and for our regular monitoring of the disease, would it be more practical if we could do some like liquid next generation sequencing to evaluate for possible mutations during the treatment rather than each time we have to go back to redo the tissue biopsy, which causes quite a bit of delay and you know, sometimes you don't yield enough satisfaction from the biopsy.
Natasha?
Sure. So I love liquid biopsy. It's so much easier, especially in the Canadian system. We probably only pick up a small number of the oncogene-driven alterations, though. So it's a nice study from Zosia Petrowska and a group where they found 13% of actionable alterations when they did plasma, but over 30% if they did the tissue biopsy. So I think it's a great screening test. You know, you can rule some things out. As Jonathan mentioned, you know, this is how we're going to find transformation. And if you don't find something, don't forget to do the biopsy. It's kind of my take home.
So, Jonathan, we'd like you to take a review of some of the data related to exon 20, novel agents in development. Quick question back to you, Natasha, from the audience. We were talking before about the AMI-laser combination, and I think you referred to the fact that now there's a survival benefit. How do you see that and sort of fitting into this complex decision-making?
So I think depending on the magnitude of survival, this may be this regimen, because this is the third regimen, right, in this space, so more challenging for uptake and for people to change their practice and get familiar. So I think if there's a very strong survival benefit, I think that will increase the strength of the recommendations that we have with our conversations with patients. It'll increase their requests for it. And I think it really will push us to make sure that we get experience, we know the data, and that we have good discussions.
All right, Jonathan, let's take a look at some more data.
Great. Pleasure to speak with you, Dr. Love, Dr. Leal, and Dr. Lee. I have the very exciting assignment of talking about EGFR, exon 20, some of the rarer EGFR mutations, but we also get to some of the new drugs that are working across EGFR subtypes. Here are my disclosures. So we're going to talk about the structure and pathophysiology of exon 20 mutations, the first-line approved regimen of amivantamab and chemotherapy. We first use AMI only in exon 20, and as Dr. Leal was discussing, has now moved much more broadly. Then we'll talk about trial agents, three TKIs, three ADCs, and put it all together. So exon 20 mutations are about 8% of all EGFR mutations. They're resistant to first, second, and third gen TKIs. NGS testing is the most sensitive and recommended. Until recently, these patients have had poor prognoses, median OS of 16 months, in the immunotherapy age, probably even worse than the non-mutated patients, because these tend not to benefit from immunotherapy. The exon 20 mutations tend to be in the C helix. There is one mutation there that's sensitive to first-gen TKIs, but that's quite rare. Most of the mutations are in the loop. Initially, a lot was made about differences in sensitivity. One of the research drugs, poziotinib, looked better in the near loop, afatinib better in the later in the loop. With the newer agents, that seems to be less important. Dr. Jonathan Rees at UC Davis showed that really there's a great diversity of exon 20 mutations, none responsible for the majority of them, and that's why we need NGS. I really like these cartoons of the wild-type EGFR mutated EGFR. In the wild-type, in the inactive setting, the C helix is blocking the active site between the N and C lobes. With ligand binding, that C helix moves up and out, up and in, and opens up that space. If we go to the deletion patients, exon 19 deletion, that top strand gets shortened, pulling the C helix out of the way. In exon 20, the bottom strand gets lengthened, pushing the C helix out of the way. Both similar outcomes, but the specific exon 20 structure prevented those first, second, and third gen drugs from getting into that cleft. Afatinib was looked at in this setting with some activity, but the dose needed for efficacy was really too high to be tolerable. So two drugs were studied about 5 years ago, mobocertinib, a TKI, and amivantamab, which we've been discussing, the bispecific. Both looked good in the phase one trials, and in 2021 got accelerated approval, but the confirmatory mobocertinib trial missed its phase three endpoint. In retrospect, we can question whether the best choice was to go against chemo rather than with chemo, and that combination strategy is what amivantamab did. Ami-chemo beat chemo alone with a very impressive hazard ratio of 0.4. So more about bispecifics. You all know blinatumomab and other T-cell engagers. This bispecific binds two proteins on the cell surface, EGFR and MET, with the idea of stronger binding and more specificity for cells that express both proteins. What we know is a common condition in EGFR mutated disease. Like many antibodies, there's multiple mechanisms of action, including blocking ligand binding, but probably most importantly, receptor internalization and degradation. Can also potentially activate macrophages and other immune cells through antibody-dependent mechanisms. We'll now move on to the research agents. So three TKIs. Beginning with furmonertinib. This recently had a name change, changing a U to an I to avoid confusion with other drugs. The FAVOR trial showed some really impressive waterfall plots. The response rate on the left waterfall plot, 79% in treatment-naive patients. The pretreated patients also had a good response rate of 46%. As part of this Project Optimus idea, the second and third waterfall plots are two different dose levels. In the pretreated patients, maybe looks a little better at the higher dose. Toxicities, I think, are really a glass half full, glass half empty situation. Very low, high-grade toxicities, but grade 2 diarrhea is really challenging as an ongoing long-term effect. And treating these patients, it's a little bit more like afatinib than like osimertinib. But I think this is a really exciting drug, really small there, but duration of response, 15 months in the treatment-naive setting, really very promising. Zipalertinib reported from the Resilient trial, a response rate of 38%, but this is mostly pretreated patients, so the activity may end up looking more like furmonertinib. Waterfall plot looks good, similar toxicities. Lastly, sunvocertinib from the Wukong trials, response rate of 71% in the treatment-naive patients, 60% in the pretreated. The toxicities, maybe a little bit higher, grade 3-4 toxicity rate. And in the bottom left, you see the blue bars are the higher dose, looks perhaps more effective, but also more toxic. We're now going to move to the antibody drug conjugates. Many of us are now familiar with these drugs, but a whole new set of lingo and concepts. Target antigen selection, looking for proteins that are overexpressed on the cell surface of the cancer cell, but not normal cells. Antibody subtype with different volumes of distribution and half-life. Internal optimization of the internalization once you have binding. Different linkers, cleavable and non-cleavable. Cytotoxic payloads, we'll go through a couple of those. site-directed versus random conjugation and drug-antibody ratio. So a lot of factors that all combine together to affect efficacy and toxicity. We're going to focus on EGFR patients. Most of the data is from the canonical EGFR mutations. Activity in atypical mutations, including exon 20, we believe can be inferred because these activities are not specific mutation dependent. We'll start with talisotuzumab vedotin, or TALISA-OV. This is a MET antibody drug conjugate, MET antibody with MMAE, a DAR, drug antibody ratio of 3.1. The MMAE is a microtubule inhibitor, and Dr. Kamage showed in the wild type in the Luminosity trial, response rate depending on the MET expression level between 24 and 35%. So useful response rates there. Toxicities from the MET inhibition, hypoalbuminemia and peripheral edema. From the MMAE, some peripheral neuropathy. Not much activity was seen as monotherapy in the EGFR mutants. So for that reason, we looked at a combination with osimertinib. Small data set, but 58% response rate, active in high and intermediate MET expression, and I hope this will be studied further in a larger study. Many drug strategies have looked at combining MET and EGFR targeting, including amivantamab, as we discussed, savolitinib, another TKI, and this TALISO-V combination may have some further utility. Now talk about HER3. The HER family we all know well, HER1 or EGFR, HER2 common in many cancers, including breast cancer. HER3, also called ERBB3, shown with the red arrow there. These all activate by dimerization and downstream signaling. And HER3 is a dimerization partner. So a paper many years ago from Jose Baselga described that combination, that this therapy may be effective in EGFR and HER2-driven tumors. And I think very excitingly, if you go back to some papers from Jeff Engelman from years ago, which really were landmark, helped us get on this MET-targeted direction, we all remember the MET part, but often forget that it was driven through HER3. So this is a cell line that's gefitinib sensitive. Gefitinib lowers EGFR, HER3, and phospho-AKT. But if you look at a gefitinib resistant cell line, yes, EGFR is not phosphorylated, but HER3 and phospho-AKT, you still see even at high doses of gefitinib. Further study looked at a silencing RNA in these EGFR mutated cell lines and showed that you were able to block that downstream AKT signaling by blocking HER3. So patritumab deruxtecan was an ADC developed based on these concepts. It's a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload, cleavable linker with a high DAR of 8 to 1. This was the Lung-01 trial, randomizing between two different dose strategies. They selected a single dose of 5.6 mg per kg every 3 weeks. And as Helena Yu reported, response rate of 30%, regardless of exon 19 or L858R, or the specific resistance mechanism that was seen to first-line osimertinib, and activity seen across all subgroups. I would say that this is one of the better tolerated ADCs, some nausea, some cytopenias, but mostly grade 1 and 2. ILD rate, ILD seen with almost all these agents, rate of about 5%. And this I find very interesting. Can we predict benefit based on HER3 expression? This is the H score. You see that most patients do have HER3 expression, but doesn't really help distinguish who is going to benefit. So is this good? Potentially you can treat a large proportion of patients, but it does call into question, do we understand how this drug is working? One of the most common questions I get from patients is, HER3 didn't come up on my NGS report. Why are you recommending this trial? Two important points. The simple answer is, we're not looking at genetic changes, we're looking at protein expression. For that, you need immunohistochemistry. But then when I say that, patients say, well, what was my immunohistochemistry score? And I say, well, in this case, it doesn't seem to matter. And then patients get really confused, understandably. These drugs do seem to have an important role. The Lung-02 trial randomized patritumab versus chemotherapy. 586 patients were enrolled, and about 6 months ago, press release described a significant improvement in PFS and some ILD as expected. That this drug is expected to be FDA approved, but they did last year run into some manufacturing problems that are yet to be resolved. Last drug, as we're finishing up here, is datopotamab deruxtecan, a TROP2-directed ADC. We know this target from sacituzumab govitecan. And this drug last month was also approved in breast cancer, TOPO1 and payload. If you look at that actionable genomic alteration patients from the Lung-01 trial, if you had an actionable genomic alteration, PFS and OS had very nice hazard ratios for benefit over docetaxel. So Myung An did a study combining those patients from the Lung-01 trial to Lung-05 patients. These were all patients with actionable genomic alterations, 117 patients in total with EGFR mutations, a great variety of mutations, and here you see the exon 20, 4% of the patients, and exciting objective response rate, and an overall survival of 15.6 months, really very promising. Toxicity is a little more chemo-like, stomatitis, alopecia, nausea, vomiting. I will call your attention to some ocular toxicities, usually dry eye or blurry vision, and some ILD at 4%. So based on this data, this drug was given priority review last month for EGFR-mutated non-small cell lung cancer in the United States. Expect to hear back in the coming months. So we reviewed the exon 20 mutations, the first-line regimen of AMI chemo, and some antibody drug conjugates and TKIs, many of which can also play a role in the later stage EGFR canonical mutations. So in summary, I would say there may be a role for all of the above, which makes this a really exciting time for treatment options for our patients.
So final question back to Natasha in terms of, again, the scenario of the patient on osimertinib who progresses. Curious, I'm not sure when patritumab may or may not be available, but in terms of Dato-DXd, which we talked about earlier in breast cancer, if it were available to you, how do you think it would factor in your decision making? And for example, how would you compare sort of quality of life efficacy of Dato compared to say chemo plus AMI plus or minus laser?
Thanks. So I'm not going to say it. I think right now, based on the evidence we have, because we haven't seen the data from the Herthena study, we haven't seen randomized data or prospectively randomized data for Dato-DXd, as I would say, OC, amivantamab plus chemotherapy, barring other alterations. How will that compare against patritumab deruxtecan? I don't know. I want to see the data, and then we'll be able to understand better, is one more tolerable than the other, or a clear winner based on indirect comparison, which we're not supposed to do. Dato-DXd, I've been reserving for third line instead of docetaxel, just based on some indirect data or some indirect assumptions from the TROPION-Lung5 study, but I've really been reserving that for after platinum plus AMI.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.